Buy with Rob is your best choice when purchasing your new home in the Puget Sound area. Call 360-710-9425 today and get started on the best home buying experience you will ever have. Go to buywithrob.com today.
Well, the place was crowded. We were packed in like sardines. They were all there to listen to the big band sounds of Tommy Dorsey. What soul? Tommy was rocking the place with a very popular tune, Salmon Chanted Evening, and the stage was surrounded by screaming groupers, probably there to see the bass player. One of them was this cute little yellowtail, and she's giving me the eye, so I figured this is my chance for a little fun, you know, piece of Pisces. But she said things I just couldn't fathom. She was too deep, seemed to be under a lot of pressure. Boy, could she drink. She drank a lot. I said, what's your sign? She said, Aquarian. I said, great, let's get tanked.
Hello?
Podcaster, verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Hello, can I talk to Mr. David? Dave Allman?
Approach and identify.
Hello?
Hey! What do you call a fish with no eyes?
Oh, I don't know.
You call it...
You'll be sorry.
Why?
You expect to eat for free or something? You gotta listen. The goody two-shoes.
And now, as I'm sure that somebody out there has said, it's time to pay for the soup.
Man, battle station's missile.
Chief of Watch, sound the general alarm.
From the Buy With Rob studio, located in beautiful Silverdale, Washington, this is the Dave Bowman Show. Now, here is your submarine-qualified, well-coffeed, stuffy, elitist history buff host, Dave Bowman.
Well, this county has first fire.
Initiating fire.
Well, good morning, good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are, whatever you do. A lot of things happening in the world today. Most of them are far beyond our control, you might say. So, perhaps it's time we took a pause and thought about life and thought about the laws of gravity, fishies, the ocean, homeless people sleeping, politicians living, hearings, politics, and or the news. Don't touch that dial. Just try to hear me out for a while. It's back to school day here. What do you call a fish with no eyes? Fresh. Politics hasn't changed in this country in 250 years, and it probably isn't going to. The Ninth Circuit Court says that arresting people for sleeping is cruel and unusual punishment. And California politicians decide finally to just do it. The hearings are the kabuki theater we've come to expect and love. Here's how you get a hold of me. The text machine is area code 209-565-DAVE. It's 565-3283. The email remains Dave at thedavebowmanshow.com. And, of course, we're on the web. Just look for The Dave Bowman Show on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, TuneIn, and whatever web browser you decide to use. Eloqui conitio, the greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance. It is the illusion of knowledge. So I thought it would get easier. It really did. Today is the first day of school. So one of the nice things about the neighborhood we live in is I think there are 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 kids that all go to the same school within, you know, a block radius. So they all catch the school bus together, including Ben. And it was just kind of interesting to watch the reactions out there. My neighbor was doing the jump up and lift up her legs in front of the bus in celebration as the kids going back to school. And I guess I'm glad Ben's going back to school. I mean, obviously, I want him to learn things, and I want him to grow in knowledge and become a fine young person. But, it's still not easy that first day. It's just not. And then I come back in the house, and I'm smiling, And my wife says, why are you smiling? Are you happy that he's back in school? Like, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to just, you know, cry right here? We had a really good summer, and it was kind of cool last night, because last night, you know, it's the last night, and we've done away with the electronics for at least an hour before bedtime, so no more Kindles, no more TV, none of that stuff. And so we read books for a while, and then he just wanted to talk. And it was kind of cool, because he wanted me to tell him about our family history, and he wanted to talk about science. So we did that for about an hour, and then he just sort of drifted off to sleep, and now he's at school. And I just go back to that first day, that very first day of preschool, when he didn't know what to expect. The first day was actually pretty easy when I took him to preschool and I dropped him off, because he didn't really know what was going on. He just, you know, it just looked fun. And it was the second day was the hard one, because that's the day he was just clinging. He knew that I was going to leave him, and he didn't want to do that. That was tough. Kindergarten was easier, but not totally easy. First grade, second grade. Now we're on to third grade. And I keep telling him, it just gets harder. The math doesn't get any easier, son. The English lessons don't get any easier. It's going to get harder. So you gotta buckle down and study this stuff. And, well, there you go. It's kind of the way my day started. So if it seems a little dusty in here at times today, just remember it's the first day of school, and that's what it is. So I want to start today with an allegory, not a metaphor, an allegory. It's a little story I picked up yesterday from the Veterans Political Group. And I'm not looking for your approval or disapproval or agreement or disagreement with the story. That's not my purpose here. A metaphor is to illustrate a point, which I'm going to try to illustrate to you amongst all of this brouhaha today, including the fish story, which just is incredulous to me. I'm assuming you've seen this story out of Hawaii, where the fish, have you seen this? All right. A fish shop in Kuwait. Why did I think Hawaii? I'm not sure why, but a fish shop in Kuwait has been closed down by authorities for using plastic googly eyes on their fish to make them look fresher for shoppers. This is not the metaphor, by the way. This is just a news story. And they have pictures of the fish with the googly eyes stuck on the fish. Social media users thought it was pretty hilarious, with one writing, if you can't stop laughing, is it really a crime? I feel like this should be allowed due to sheer ballsiness. I'm expecting Jack in the Box Jack to start running commercials about his fish balls. If this was America, we'd be praising these guys and calling them entrepreneurs. Not sure about that, but never judge the freshness of a fish by the googliness of its eyes. Anyway, it's been, the internet has just loved this. And of course, I don't eat fish, so this is just another reason for me not to eat fish. But it sounded fishy to me when I first saw the story, but it turns out it was true. I looked it up and I got it. They really did this. They really glued googly eyes to the fish, the dead fish, so that people would think that they were fresher than they really were. Because if you see them without the googly eyes on it, they're pretty, pretty disgusting. But then fish are anyway. So now on to the allegory, because that's what got me thinking about fish. And then this story popped up, which has nothing to do with fish, but it's a metaphor. No, it's an allegory. Sorry, not a metaphor. To kind of illustrate the point I want to talk today. A little girl was at the zoo and leaned into the lion's cage. Suddenly, the lion grabs her by the collar of her jacket and tries to pull her inside, obviously to slaughter her under the watching eyes of her screaming parents. Nearby, a biker jumped off his Harley, runs to the cage, hits the lion square on the nose with a powerful punch. The lion, whimpering in pain, lets go of the little girl. The biker scoops her up, brings her back to her terrified parents, who thank him endlessly. There happened to be a reporter on scene who saw the entire event, and he went to the Harley rider and said, "Sir, this is the most gallant and bravest thing I've ever seen a man do in my whole life." To which the Harley rider says, "Well, it's really nothing. The lion was behind bars. I just saw this little kid in danger and acted as I felt was right. The reporter says, well, we'll make sure this does not go unnoticed. I'm a journalist, you know, and tomorrow's paper will have this story on the front page. So tell me what you do for a living and what's your political affiliation? The biker replies, I'm a U.S. Marine, a Republican, and I voted for Trump. The next morning, biker buys the paper to see if indeed the news of his action was on the front page, and it was, with this headline, U.S. Marines assaults African immigrant and steals his lunch. Now, the thrust of the story is, you know, dealing with the media and how it deals with things today. And the problem that we face with our politics is illustrated to some degree by this story. The fact is that if you are a conservative Trump supporting Republican or even, you know, not a conservative or not a political leftist, you probably see some grain of truth in an allegory such as that. If you're on the political left, you get upset by something like that and saying, you know, those dumb people believe anything, don't they? And it goes back to the conversation that we've had on numerous occasions, which is that politics in this country hasn't changed in the entire history of this country. I know we think it has. I know because I hear it almost every morning on my local news. We've never been more divided. There's one particular news babe who does political interest stories. I guess that's what you would call them. And she has a whole segment about bringing people together because we've never been more divided. And the thing I hate about that segment is they do it early in the week and then they rerun it over and over and over again. It's like, good Lord. Is there anything else on right now? Oh, yay, the Kavanaugh hearings. Yeah. Not sure I'd rather watch that. But at any rate, we've never been more divided is the mantra of today. And I really, truly believe there's a reason why people say that. And that is, number one, there's actually a couple reasons. But number one reason is they have no concept of American history. They do not know the history of our country. And when you look at them and go, really? We've never been more divided? Never, ever have we been more divided. They look at you with this innocent eyes and this kind of wry grin on their face and say, it's true, I've never seen it like this. Oh, well, if you've never seen it like this, that must make it true, right? We as a country have never been more divided. And then you remind them of things like, what was that? Civil War. And they either have some excuse for why that wasn't a division, or they have a recognition of going, oh yeah, I forgot about that. Which scares me. So you have this element of ignorance in this, and you have this second element, which is intent. There's a reason why the narrative, the mantra that we've never been more divided is so pushed. Because you see, if you can get people to believe that we've never been more divided, then that implies that there has to be a solution. Right? We have to solve this. This is a problem. We must solve the problem. Therefore, we must have a solution to the problem, whatever solution that might be. And what solutions do you hear to this issue that we've never been more divided? I've been watching this now for years. Realistically, the only solutions I see offered to this idea that we've never been more divided are to make one side or the other completely shut up. In other words, do away with the ideas of free speech, free expression that we have existed upon, that we have placed upon a pedestal, that we honor deeply in our society, to do away with that. Because it creates division. As if somehow or another, everything in our Bill of Rights doesn't create division. The only thing not creating any division in our Bill of Rights right now is the Third Amendment, because, you know, that's why we build bases, so we don't have to quarter troops yet right now. But someday, if we ever have to quarter troops, you can be sure that there will be people that will be for it. They will explain to you that it's a national security issue and we have to do that. And then there will be people who stand up and go, wait, we have a right not to do this. And we need to debate and discuss this. And then they'll be labeled as this, or they'll be labeled as that. And that argument will happen. You go through the Bill of Rights, pick any right you want, and you will have people on both sides of it. But somehow or another, this division that we have now, the only solution that's been offered is to make one side or the other shut up. That's it. That's we can make them quiet. We can shadow ban them. We can tell them that they can't say things that are anti-vaccination. We can say that you can't question global warming. We can say we can put those people in jail. And don't tell me that hasn't been suggested. We've seen this. Somehow or another, nobody ever seems to get to the solution of, well, maybe we should have a war about it. Because even today, we recognize the fact that that's a little extreme. That may be going just a tad bit too far. That's just crazy. So, you know, well, maybe we haven't been divided as we were then, but we have. But the truth of the matter is our country has always been divided. And the biggest division in this country has never been socioeconomic status. It's never been rich versus poor. It's never been race. Black versus white, brown versus white, whatever. That's not the biggest division. I'm not saying there's not divisions there. What I'm saying is there have not been the biggest divisions. The biggest division has always been and always will be the mercantile academic elite versus the country folk. And by country folk, I don't mean people who necessarily live out in rural areas. And by mercantile elite, I don't necessarily mean people who live in Boston. What I mean are people who have those mentalities and those assumptions about the other side. Look at me. I'm educated. I have 3 degrees and I work at a $100,000 a year job. And I'm, you know, I drive a Mercedes and I have a Rolex. Anybody who doesn't think the way I think or see things the way I see them must be stupid. And on the other side, you've got people looking at those folks going, God, what a bunch of pretentious asshats. I'm glad I don't think the way they think. I'll keep my guns and God and I'll cling to those things because these are the things that bring me comfort. And I don't need their ways of thinking. That's the biggest divide in this country. It always has been. It goes back to the ratification debates, folks. Remember the South Carolina legislature passing laws designed to pacify the rural folk because they weren't capable of really understanding what we were trying to do here. Even James Madison was mad in Virginia because he didn't understand why the public wouldn't just listen to him. Why don't they just take my word for it when I tell them that this is good? Why do they have to? How dare they argue with me? I'm James Madison. I wrote the thing. That division has always existed, and it has always come with those stresses, and it has always resulted in friction, and you see it today. You see it even as we watch the hearings for Brett Kavanaugh. You see the condescension of the mercantile academic elite as they look down upon those who would dare support a mainline judge. I mean, this is not good enough for us. We don't think so. And the other side screaming, what a bunch of buffoons those people are. As if neither side has anything intelligent or important to say. And you go back to this little metaphor that I gave you. And the problem that we have in this country is, I don't even know that it's a problem. The division that we have in this country is that there's nobody willing to, not even John McCain, sorry. I know he claims that he was crossed the line and stuff, but really John McCain was about John McCain. There's no understanding of the fact that we can sit down and talk to each other and not just assume that the other side is an idiot. Not just assume that the other side is uneducated because they don't have 5 degrees from an Ivy League university. You don't have a degree. Well, you must be stupid. Well, you were dumb enough to pay for a degree from an Ivy League college. Your mama didn't raise you right because obviously, you know, your degree in macroeconomics, South American macroeconomics, how's that working out for you? How's those payments on that student loan to pay for all that? You know, we each side looks at the other side as the idiot. It's just a fact. Each side does. And neither side seems willing to extend the concept that there are different ways to teach people. There are different ways of learning. There are different levels of understanding things, different ways of understanding things. There are different objectives. There are different ideologies. We're not willing to do that. And as long as that divide has always existed and always will exist, you're not going to do away with it. But what you will see eventually is you begin to see backlash about it. As one side or the other becomes predominant, the other side tends to lash back. And this little allegory that I shared with you is about that lashing back, isn't it? It's about the way the people who might be convinced otherwise if you had a normal conversation are so tired of being bashed upon, so tired of being put upon, so tired of being laughed at, criticized, pointed at, begin to hit back. And then you have more division, and then you have more conflict, and you have more arguments and more debates and more frustration and surprise from the other side that, whoa, well, I wasn't expecting that. I've bullied these people for years and they've just taken it. Now all of a sudden they're hitting back. What the heck's going on here? Well, that's not right. We better pass a law making so that they can't do that. You watch what's happening in the hearings right now, and that's the feeling you get. I'm telling you, even if you're on the left, and look, I'm no huge Judge Kavanaugh fan. I consider them to be real concerns with Judge Kavanaugh's judicial philosophy. I have a problem with a judge who thinks that national security is more important than the Fourth Amendment. I'm sorry, I just do. I don't give a rat's ass about abortion. I don't care about gay marriage. What I care about are constitutional, fundamental, written down in the Constitution rights. And Judge Kavanaugh has made it clear that he believes at least one of those critical rights is subservient to whatever the government decides is national security. And yet we haven't heard a single question about that, have we? Not one. All we've heard is, God, what's his name? Orrin Hatch, drone on in that annoying voice of his that makes me want to claw my eardrums out. All we've heard from him is about, oh, he's great. He's great. He's great. And all we've heard from the other side, led by 2020 presidential candidate Kamala Harris, is we don't have enough documents. We don't have enough documents. And the fact of the matter is that everybody in that room already knows how they're going to vote on this. The whole Congress, the whole Senate already knows how they're going to vote on this. It's just theater. That's all it is. That's what frustrates me, is we could be using this for actual conversations. We could actually be talking about this. Instead, we're talking about U.S. Marine assaults African immigrant and steals his lunch. Because whatever you politically have already decided is how you feel, without any facts, without any questions, without any discussions, is how you are reacting to these hearings. Oh, Judge Kavanaugh is going to take away my fundamental right to abortion. Really? That's your big concern? That's what you care about? Oh, Judge Kavanaugh is going to secure the rule of law. Well, what does that mean? What does rule of law mean? I know what it means to me. What does it mean to you? We don't have any of those conversations, do we? The only conversations we have are conversations where, you know, this guy's great. This guy's fantastic. Can't wait to have more of this guy because we need more of this kind of person on the. No, we need to have this guy. He's the one we got to have. No, you need to be quiet and listen to me because I'm in charge here. And bam, 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 gavels and gavels and this, that, and the other. And that's all we get from this nonsense. And in the meantime, the lion didn't get to kill the little girl, and nobody's celebrating that fact, but we're more divided than we've ever been. Everything is. It's kabuki theater and it's nonsense. And we could be having reasonable, rational discussions, but we don't have those anymore. That's the biggest change in this country in politics, is we can't sit down and have a discussion. We can't have a convention where we sit down and people go, well, I'm against it and here's why, and we'll have a debate and a discussion, and then we'll, you know, decide. Instead, what we have is headlines telling us what we already think. And depending on what letter you've decided is after your name, that's how you think. You haven't put any thought into it yourself at all. technically, I have an R after my name. I'm not a Republican for all practical purposes, and believe me, the Republican Party would definitely wish I would quit saying that. I have real issues with Judd Kavanaugh. He would not have been my first pick. I understand why he was chosen, but I would have gone for a libertarian judge every time. And now you got senators out there claiming that this guy was only chosen to break the tie. Well, no kidding, dumbass. Elections have consequences. Remember, didn't we say that a few years ago? Yeah, we did. Instead of having conversations, we're just using that mantra. We've never been more divided, and so we have to have a solution to this division. That solution is whichever side is stronger is going to make the other side shut up. And if we can disappear our precious rights that way, if we can make our precious and honored rights disappear by simply saying, well, you need to shut up because you're causing division, how long is it before the rest of them go away under the same conditions? How long is it before the rest of them are just googly eyes stuck on a fish to make it smell fresh and look fresh, but it's still a dead, stinky fish? How long? How long until then? And Pat makes the point in the chat room that the fact is many people are after the names aren't Republicans anymore. That's probably true, but how come the same isn't true the other way? How come many people with D's after their names aren't really Democrats anymore? If there really was this movement to solve this problem, wouldn't that be the case? We've never been more divided. It's complete nonsense, folks. And it's manipulative, and it's designed to manipulate us. It's designed to make us feel like we need a solution. Something has to change. We've got to do something different because we can't have this. Yes, we can. We always have. It's the beauty of this country. It's the beauty of being an American is the fact that we argue about everything vociferously, loudly, longly. We call each other names. We point each other fingers at each other. And at the end of the day, unlike a lot of other places, we're still here. We still protect our rights. We recognize a googly-eyed fish for what it is. And many people recognize a headline for what it is. And that's becoming more and more true. People are realizing that, yeah, it's just become a caricature of itself. We know the truth. We know what's really going on. And we recognize it for what it is. It's half past. Stay with us. We got to take a break. We'll be back right after this on the Dave Bowman Show.
This is the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. You are listening to The Dave Bowman Show on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
Hey, welcome back. Tis I, Dave. This is a Wednesday. It is not Constitution Thursday, but an interesting ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court today. I don't know if you've seen this or not. And it's one of those universal rulings that's going to affect everywhere. Seattle is paying attention to this. I'm sure my old hometown of Modesto is paying attention to this. Your city is paying attention to this. According to the Ninth Circuit Court, they'd like to be the Supreme Court, but they're not. Prosecuting people who are homeless for sleeping on public property when they have no access to shelter violates the Constitution's ban, the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. That's kind of a interesting way to look at it. So let's see here. Just so I'm clear, arresting a homeless person who's sleeping on a public property, putting them in a jail cell, feeding them, making sure they stay warm and don't freeze to death, is now cruel and unusual. I'm not sure the Ninth Circuit Court really understands the definition of either of those two words, but their rationale here is really intriguing to me because it's actually something that I've been saying for quite a while, and I have some practical experience with. Ninth Circuit Court unanimously overturned a district court decision in favor of the city of Boise, in which homeless people challenged two city ordinances that barred them from staying overnight on public property. The challengers, who had been cited under the Boise ordinances, sought damages. In essence, what happened is the Boise Police Department decided in 2010 to prohibit, and skip that paragraph. They continue to cite homeless people on nights when there was availability in shelters. The Ninth Circuit Court, however, cited evidence that some shelters limited the number of days a homeless person could stay or turned away people who arrived after certain hours. In other words, the shelters had rules about the availability of their beds. You know, you got to be in here at a certain time, and they limited the number of nights you could stay. I never really understood that one, but I do understand, you know, the turning away people of after hours. Now, again, when I ran a shelter, my policy was if there was an available bed, we didn't turn anybody away on that basis. In other words, we did our intake at a set time. And if you wanted a guaranteed bed, you probably better be there. But if for some reason someone couldn't be there until later, you know, usually if they let us know or if we had a bed later on, we didn't really turn people away on that basis. The idea of, you know, you can only stay a certain number of nights. I know shelters that have done that. I never understood that policy and I never enacted that policy, but I know shelters that have done that. However, there was a bigger concern, and this is the thing was that the police were saying, the city was saying there are available shelter beds, and the homeless people were saying, no, they're not. And it came down to an issue of religious involvement. In other words, you were required by some of the shelters to make some sort of religious commitment in order to use their shelter. Now, that commitment could have been as simple as, you know, we're going to have a prayer before we go to bed at night, or you have to sit through a meeting in order to receive the services we provide, much like the Star Trek episode I played at the top of the hour. Where Edith Keeler, you know, you don't get the, now it's time to pay for the soup. You got to listen to Miss Goody Two Shoes. And that wasn't necessarily religious, but it was the same kind of mentality. Again, I grew up in the Salvation Army. My father was the Corps officer, the commanding officer of the Harbor Light Corps in Denver, Colorado, which was a transitional housing thing for alcoholic men. But it was also a soup kitchen. But in order to get your soup, you had to listen to my dad preach. And that's just the way it was. You had to listen to the meeting first. And believe me, I've seen guys fall asleep in the meeting because, you know, that's what happens. I've fallen asleep while my dad's preaching before. And they'd get, you know, tossed out because they didn't succeed and they didn't get to eat. And the court decided that element of religious persuasion essentially made it illegal for the city of Boise to say that there are shelter beds available, therefore we can cite you, because if the requirement was that you had to perform some sort of religious, you know, activity, whatever that might be, then you can't say that that's an open shelter bed, because it's not. It's a shelter bed that comes with requirements that you can't put on citizens per se. I don't know how much of a problem this is going to be in Boise. I'm pretty sure it's not going to be a problem in Seattle. I'm reasonably sure that Seattle doesn't, most of the shelters there. I know that the shelter I ran in Modesto, California did not. In fact, there were people who pushed me really hard to add a religious component to that because we were the Salvation Army and because we do social services in the name of Christ and all these kind of things. There were a lot of people who pushed really hard to have some religious component to it. The problem was, of course, and this is the way I got around it at the time, was that, you know, there's two arguments here. Number one, our own founder, General William Booth, used to say that a person that's hungry and dirty, needs a shower, isn't going to listen to what you have to say. Feed them and get them cleaned up first, then they'll listen to what you have to say. So there's that element of it. And the second element of it was, of course, we were taking federal money in the form of CDBG grants. We accepted federal money. And so I used to have to explain to people who were pretty passionate about the fact that you're not doing the Salvation Army's work. Well, actually, I am. But, you know, when that federal dollars are involved, you really can't force people to participate in a religious activity. In fact, I used to get irritated when forced to participate in religious activities that I felt were not related in ways that they should have been. So I always kind of understood that. And I think it's interesting that the city of Boise police were using that religious element of these shelters to claim that there were open beds and then arrest them and you know, put them in jail where they fed them and kept them warm. Boise, I mean, you know, even in August, Boise's cold. Can you imagine what being homeless like? I don't know why anybody would be homeless in Boise. I mean, seriously, go to Santa Monica, for God's sake. Go to San Diego. Go to some place where you don't have to worry about those things. Anyway, Cammy and I have that conversation on a regular basis. Where would we go if we were homeless? What would we do if somehow or another circumstances changed and we ended up homeless? Where would we go? And I've always said Santa Monica. Are you crazy? We're going to Santa Monica. There's some reasons. Santa Monica, number one, the weather is fantastic. Number two, they have showers and bathrooms. And number three, they'll let homeless people sleep on their beach, but not my dog. My dog is banned from their beach, but not the homeless people. So that's the place to go, I'm telling you. Anyway, it was an interesting ruling to me, and I'm finding myself kind of agreeing with the Ninth Circuit Court's decision, but not its logic. I don't think it's cruel and unusual to arrest people who are homeless because, again, the intention is not to punish them per se. It's not. We've talked about this in the past in Modesto. The problem that we had was the homeless people on the streets. It would get cold and they would take actions, usually destructive actions, to either get themselves arrested or get themselves someplace warm. And so by providing someplace warm, we were able to get them off the streets and reduce that destructiveness that they were causing. And in fact, we showed pretty clearly that for the cost of $39,000 a year in CDBG funds, we were saving the city roughly $250,000 a year in processing and arresting and in all of that, the homeless people that they had been arresting. So, you know, everybody has this idea of homelessness. We've got to solve the homeless problem. Well, sometimes the solution is just not as difficult as people want to make it because those aren't the solutions that they want. What they want is for the homeless people to be miraculously transformed from the dual diagnosed people that they are, libertarian people that they are, to what you want them to be as citizens. And that's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. Same thing happens on 110 degrees day. Pat's right. In the chat room there, it's hot. I want to go to an air-conditioned jail cell where I can get some water and some food. It happens, folks. It's not unusual. I've seen homeless people throw a brick through a window hoping to get arrested because they didn't want to sleep on the streets at night. And the shelter gave them that opportunity not to have to do that. I don't agree that it's cruel and unusual punishment to do that because in some ways it's protective custody. You could make that argument. It's maybe you're just protecting the community from the destruction that this person will cause in an attempt to gain shelter. Or maybe you're protecting them from themselves. It's possible. But at the same time, is that cruel and unusual? I don't think it is. I mean, it's kind of the history of, for God's sake, Tom Petty has a verse in a song about getting arrested because you didn't have any place to stay. So this whole idea that this is cruel and unusual is a little far-fetched. I don't know where this will go. I don't see this one going to the Supreme Court of the United States. But I did think it was an interesting ruling. I did think it was fascinating to see the court decide on that stuff. And I actually do agree with you can't force people to go to a religious commitment in order to get a bed. Realistically speaking, I mean, I'm not Christian, so take it for what it's worth. But if you really believe that you're doing this in the name of Christ, shouldn't you just give him a bed anyway? When did Jesus put that requirement on there? Because I don't remember it being on there. In fact, what I remember him saying is treat others the way you'd want to be treated, which, you know, of course, is from the Torah. But hey, there you go. Speaking of lawmakers, see what the California state legislature did. Oh, one of the last bills they passed. This is wonderful. For those of you that have been with the show for a long time, you're gonna recognize why this is wonderful. For those of you that are relatively new to the show or haven't listened in a long time, maybe you might not get why this amuses me so much. Senate Bill 1250, Senator Stephen Bradford, Democrat, Gardenia, basically says that the address listed on the lawmaker's voter registration will now be accepted as the primary residence, as long as they actually lived at that address for, quote, an unspecified period of time, unquote. Da, 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 da. This bill is about allowing all legislators who must travel and live in our state capital to be, travel and live, get that part, in our state capital to be effective leaders for our representative districts without the fear of being targeted by overzealous prosecutors or political adversaries. Having been one of those political adversaries who was, look, what happened was a lot of these guys don't live in the districts what they represent. Now, their argument is, well, the 14th Amendment and the Constitution don't require, but the state constitution of California does. It requires a legislator in the state legislature, not the national one, the state one, to actually reside in the district in which they won for a year before they can run. But they claim, no, we don't have to. And so it creates a whole lot of brouhaha. It creates a lot of carpet bagging. It creates a lot of people, you know, living wherever the hell they want. And oddly enough, this is the part that really still amazes me. The black legislator from Los Angeles who didn't live in his district, he gets convicted of this and, you know, kicked out of the legislature. The white guy is doing the same thing up in our district. Nobody even investigated him. And I never understood that for the life of me. I didn't understand why there wasn't outrage over that, but there wasn't. So now they've passed a law allowing the legislators to live outside their district, which, of course, flies in the face of the Constitution. The state constitution clearly says, nope, you got to live in the district. So what do you think the state courts are going to decide on that? Do you think they're going to jump on that? By the way, it wasn't just me. The Sacramento Bee got all over people. Richard Pan, the senator from Sacramento, doesn't live in his district. And they pointed that. The Sacramento Bee pointed that out. They always have an excuse as to why. They always have an excuse. I just think it's amusing that the state legislature has passed a law saying that they don't want to live in their districts. They want to live in Sacramento. Has any legislator ever gotten in trouble in Sacramento? Have they ever gotten in trouble for being pulled over in Sacramento? The cop pulls out their license and says, well, this is where you live in, you know, La Jolla. No, I live here in Sacramento because I'm a state legislator, and they've ever gone, well, that's bad. You've got to get no, that's never happened. It never will happen. But somehow or another, these legislators now have decided that state constitution, we don't need that. We don't got to follow that. We'll pass a law. And I'm sure Tom Berryhill is happy about this because Tom was one of the worst offenders at this. And we made a lot of hay with that back in the day on the show. He was a state legislator who did not live in the district in which he was running. But he didn't care. And neither did his Republican supporters. They were all like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. He's got a right to do this. Even though the Constitution says he doesn't, he does. We've decided. And of course, he was white, so he gets away with it. While the guy down in L.A. who's black, he gets convicted of it. Now, grant you, he was dumb enough to lie about it on the stand. But, you know, the principal's the same. He didn't live in his district either. The white guy didn't even get investigated. Black guy, kick him out of the legislature. And there you go. On and on it goes. Tom Berryhill, by the way, is missing in action. For those of you back home, nobody knows where he is. Yes, he's technically still, well, he was until Friday, technically still in the state Senate, may still be until the next changeover, but nobody knows where he is. I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. Mike Dunbar has a great article about the fact that nobody knows where Tom Berryhill is. He's disappeared. And I was having a great discussion with this about with my predecessor on the air, Bill Mick, because when he was on the air, there's a big controversy about Tom's heart transplant, but now he's disappeared and there's all kinds of speculation about what's going on. Is he sick? Is he disappeared? What's going on? Where's Tom Berryhill? I can tell you where he's not, which is in Modesto, because that's not where he lives. But now he's helped pass a law that says he doesn't have to anyway, so it's okay, right? It doesn't matter at all. Constitution, who needs that? That's just a pain in the ass. We don't need that. Sergeant Alfonso Orlando Duran. I don't know if you knew, you probably never heard of this guy. He was from New Mexico and was temporarily assigned. He was a fill-in nose gunner for a B-24 named Knock It Off. That B-24 was a part of the Big Week Offensive, what was known as the Big Week Offensive or Operation Argument, which was a 1944, February of 1944. It was an attempt by the Allies and their air forces to lure the German Luftwaffe into a climactic battle, as it were. The idea here was to get the Luftwaffe to commit everything to this battle. Then we'd have our P-51s jump them and we'd finish this thing once and for all. And of course, nothing ever works out the way that it's supposed to. Nothing ever happens away. I mean, the bombing campaign went successfully. It wasn't an unsuccess in the broader scheme of things. The Germans lost 262 fighters, with 100 of their best fighter pilots ended up being killed in action. The flip side of this, though, is that the U.S. Army Air Force, Army Air Corps, as it was called then, lost 226 heavy bombers and 2,000 aircrew killed or captured in the process of this little attempt to lure the Luftwaffe into this final battle. And one of those guys that was killed or was missing is a guy by the name of Sergeant Alfonso Orlando Duran. He was a substitute nose gunner, as I said, on this B-24 that was hit by flak over what was then Yugoslavia. He was the only member of the crew that did not bail out of the airplane. And at the time, when the other nine guys were captured and they were interviewed later and they were talked to, and they said that he wasn't hurt. He just wouldn't jump out. He just froze. And there you have it. Plane crashed. The German forces reported recovering a body and it disappeared. It was buried in a local cemetery there and along with some other guys into a kind of a mixed grave, and it just sort of disappeared. And even after the war, for 6 years after the war, the United States Army, and the United States Department of Defense tried to find, you know, missing in action people, 73,000 servicemen. Do you get that? 73,000 are still technically missing from World War II. We have no idea where they are. These aren't, you know, people that died that we know where they're buried. 73,000 are still unaccounted for. And until this week, Sergeant Duran was one of those guys. Through a long 70-year process, his family trying to find out what happened, they finally decided that this grave was probably him. For the longest time, it had been listed as an Australian flyer, but it didn't make any sense, and there was a lot of discussion about that, and they were still concerns and questions and all that kind of stuff. But they finally exhumed this body in what used to be Yugoslavia, and that was course, part of the problem was Yugoslavia wasn't exactly cooperating with our search for our missing servicemen. But they recovered Sergeant Duren's body. Found it 2000. They found the location in 2006. In 2017, they exhumed him. And they have returned Sergeant Duren to his family in New Mexico, where he was buried this past month, the Santa Fe National Cemetery. "Flag made my heart sing," wrote one of the family members. "It's a rosette. It's a mark that this man was finally found and accounted for." I'm blown away by the fact that there are still 73,000 unaccounted for and missing. There are millions of people missing during World War II that we'll never account for, but here it is all these years later, and we're still looking, we're still finding, and we're still getting closure. And Sergeant Alonzo Orlando Duren, killed February 25th, 1944, beloved son and brother, is home in his beloved New Mexico. I got to get running. Take the time right now. Tell the people that matter in your life you love them very much. You'd miss them if they weren't there, so don't pass up those opportunities. Don't want to have that regret. Plausibly Live, I am Dave Bowman, and this is my show, The Dave Bowman Show, right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. You can send me an email, dave@thedavebowmanshow.com. Comment on our Facebook page, Twitter, even the regular page of thedavebowmanshow.com. And listen to all the other great shows we have for you at podcast99.org. Coming up next, Tim Preuss. He's got a much more detailed look than I was able to give you on the Kavanaugh hearings today. That's on the radio side. Just go to podcast99.org and click on the Listen Live button, and you can listen to Tim. Or you can check out the Yale Evangelist and Jay's Politics blog and all the back shows on us as well. By the way, check out the website today, thedavebowmanshow.com. I put in there some stuff, some more information about the Scorpion show that we did on Monday, if you're intrigued by that. Have a great rest of your day, everybody. And we will see you tomorrow for a Thursday episode of The Dave Bowman Show right here on the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network.
The Dave Bowman Show is a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Internet Radio Network. For more information or to complain about how the show offended you, the text or voicemail number is 209-565-DAVE. For more information about the show, log on to thedavebowmanshow.com.
Hey, I'm going to go do something productive. I'm going to go watch television.